Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Glass Half Broken, Shattering the Barriers That Still Hold Women Back at Work, by Colleen Ammerman and Boris Groysberg. Narrated by Chloe Cannon. Publisher's note: this audiobook has bonus material of visual elements supporting the text. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. Introduction. The Stalled Workplace Revolution. In 2019, women made up the majority of college-educated U.S. workers for the first time ever, and the gap between the percentage of women versus men in the labor force was the lowest on record. Other developed countries have also seen women enter the labor force in greater numbers, even Japan, where women's workforce participation has long lagged behind other large economies, has experienced an uptick in recent years. While the COVID-19 pandemic upended the global economy in early 2020 and chipped away at these gains, such milestones ought to suggest that women are becoming more and more represented in positions of leadership across business and society. The hard-fought battles of the 20th century to provide gender-equal access to education, job training, and employment opportunities enable women today to pursue careers without being denied entry into degree programs, without being summarily barred from certain occupations or ranks, and without the threat of being dismissed when they get married. But women, in fact, remain underrepresented, often dramatically so, in positions of power. The proportion of female CEOs struggles to break 10% across a variety of indices. The gender pay gap is showing little movement, largely because high-paying jobs are the most gender imbalanced. Today's most remunerative fields, particularly high finance and tech, are also those where women are most scarce. But even in fields that employ roughly equal proportions of men and women, or where women actually make up the majority, leadership ranks remain male-dominated. Female CEOs are about as rare in the healthcare sector as they are in any other, despite a huge supply of women. Three-quarters of the healthcare workforce is female. In 2020, just 13 of the companies on Fortune's Global 500 list, the world's largest companies by revenue, were led by women, and none of those female CEOs were women of color. As this book went to press, Citigroup joined the list, announcing that longtime executive Jane Fraser would become CEO in early 2021. In the United States, women have received the majority of undergraduate degrees, prerequisites for high-earning jobs, since the 1980s. Across all racial and ethnic categories tracked by the federal government, women earn more than half of college degrees. The gates have been opened, and women have stepped through. Yet they have found themselves staring down a set of obstacles that can't be adjudicated away. Glass Half Broken, Shattering the Barriers That Still Hold Women Back at Work, is an exploration of the moment we've arrived at, with women's progress into positions of leadership and authority stalled for years, and why the status quo persists. The book is also about the individual and institutional strategies deployed to overcome these barriers, how well they have worked, and what it will take to create real change. Our own institution, Harvard Business School, HBS, started educating women in 1937, yet didn't begin admitting women students directly to our MBA program until 1963. Like many other schools, HBS initially approached the presence of women students as a challenge of integration, that is, how to add and assimilate women to the classroom and the campus. Underlying was the assumption that the school's existing norms and practices need not be altered, the so-called add women and stir approach. More recently, HBS has taken a candid look at its history and at the ways in which we continue to fall short of aims to provide equal opportunities and supports for all students, regardless of gender, race, or any other identity category. In the epilogue, we will explore the school's decades-long and ongoing journey toward equality. Both of us have been deeply involved in the efforts to make HBS a place where every member of the community, from students to faculty and staff, is able to thrive and contribute to our shared educational mission, we, along with numerous colleagues, have worked to improve our curricula, advance research on inequality and inclusion, and use the school's platform to communicate with leaders who can change the culture of business. This book is our attempt to take what we've learned from this work and provide educators, managers, and anyone who wants to better understand why gender parity remains elusive with a clear view of the structures and mindsets that perpetuate inequities, as well as a guide for dismantling them. We are indebted to the many scholars who have conducted critical and groundbreaking research on gender in organizations and in leadership. Throughout this book, we cite the work of numerous researchers from the fields of organizational behavior, psychology, economics, sociology, and law, including a number of our HBS colleagues, as well as some of our own past research. Our aim has been to synthesize the most critical findings and explain what they mean for women's careers in real workplaces and what they suggest about how to affect change. In addition, we conducted a series of new research projects, surveying and interviewing women and men around the world at all career stages and levels of organizational hierarchy, from undergraduates just starting out to seasoned executives serving on corporate boards. Across all these projects, more than 300 people were interviewed. In addition, we collected survey responses from more than 275 women executives. We heard from people on every continent except Antarctica. They were working in sales, marketing, operations, human resources, and other functions across all manner of industries. Most worked in for-profit companies, both privately held and publicly traded, but a sizable minority were employed at nonprofits and academic institutions. They came from all sorts of socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds, and their stories were inspiring and often moving. They confirm much of what we know from academic research about how and why gender disparities persist, but they also offer the texture and vividness of first-person experience, helping us to absorb and more fully understand the effects of the biases and barriers long studied by researchers. Our interviews also shed light on how women have overcome obstacles and how both women and men are trying to take down barriers. Most of the people we spoke to have thought deeply, not only about their own careers, but also about how to enable those around them to succeed. Throughout the book, we have included profiles of real women and men. The trailblazers in these stories reflect the transformations in women's opportunities, as well as the ways their potential is still stymied. Moreover, they are a reminder that big changes to society, to business, to major institutions are always the collective work of committed individual actors. We hope that these stories likewise remind listeners that they too have the power to be change agents. The book is organized into two sections, with the first half of the book focused on how, despite decades of corporate initiatives, public policy programs, and grassroots activism, gender-based inequities continue to limit women's careers and maintain the male-dominated status quo in leadership. The second half of the book zeroes in on how to eliminate gender gaps in organizations, with chapters devoted to what men can do to be effective allies, what companies need to do at an organizational level to drive systemic change, and what individual managers should do to promote equity on a day-to-day basis. Chapter 1 focuses on the barriers to advancement that begin early in women's careers and the obstacles to leadership that keep even high-achieving women from the uppermost echelons. We talk to women on the rise, some about to graduate from college, others earning MBAs, and some a handful of years into their post-grad careers. They are already quite accomplished, products of competitive, elite environments where their ambitions were encouraged and their hard work rewarded. Those on the cusp of careers generally believe that the path to success is clear. But women who have been working for just a few years, sometimes as little as 12 months out of college, are already starting to observe an unequal playing field. As they move further into their careers, they are beset by the roadblocks that characterize today's workplace. skepticism about and stigma for working mothers, a lack of role models who share their gender, compounded for women of color who are highly unlikely to see leaders who look like them, and the first signs of the double bind that forces women to choose between being liked and being respected, with career costs no matter which tack they take. In Chapter 2, we talk to women who have made it through this gauntlet and risen to senior executive roles in companies around the world. We learn about the factors that made their success possible, in particular, the outsize impact made by the small number of female role models in view. We also identify how gender-based barriers evolve, like a drug-resistant affliction, to create new disadvantages for women leaders. The female executives we studied were often still navigating the double bind while being the only woman at their level or in their immediate peer group, which added a new level of scrutiny. Even though they had more power than at any other point in their careers, they spent significant time managing how male colleagues at all levels perceived and received them, a distraction from and a burden on their actual work. While they have made it further than most other women of their cohorts, they continue to be thwarted in their attempts to reach parity with the men around them. Chapter 3 takes us higher still in the corporate hierarchy, where there are even fewer women. We go into the corporate boardroom. Gender diversity, or the lack thereof, on company boards has garnered increasing attention in recent years, but interest outpaces progress. We look at how various actors, from governments to investors to women directors themselves, are exerting pressure on boards and why corporate governance, with its enormous influence on business and society, remains essentially the purview of white men. We acknowledge that the population we focus on at each of these stages is an elite one, graduates of top schools, employees of name-brand companies, highly paid executives, women in low-wage jobs, the service industry, trades, domestic work, and the informal economy are fighting very different, more fundamental battles for a living wage, basic job protections, and safe working conditions, among other vital needs. The obstacles faced by the professional women we have studied should never be the sole focus of the conversation about gender and work. But the fact that even this privileged group remains fundamentally thwarted by gender inequality is a stark reminder of just how much that inequality continues to shape organizations and careers. Gender barriers cannot be elided by the advantages of education and income. They will limit all women's opportunities until they are uprooted and dismantled. In Part 2, we turn to action. Chapter 4 focuses on the most underutilized weapon in the battle against gender inequality, men. They themselves stand to gain, we argue, from combating gender stereotypes, and they are disproportionately in positions to shape policy and culture. Yet their voices are often absent from conversations about gender inequality. In this chapter, we explore why men remain largely on the sidelines, the untapped potential of male advocates, and how men at all levels, not just high-profile leaders, can create meaningful change. Chapter 5 shifts from individual actors to organizations, asking what practices companies can put in place to address, prevent, and mitigate the barriers hindering women's careers. We synthesize our own and others' research about all aspects of talent management, from hiring to evaluation to retention, offering a practical framework that organizations can start applying tomorrow. Drawing on behavioral science, studies of organizational structure and culture, and our own interviews with women and men across dozens of companies, we adapt the insights of research to the day-to-day processes involved in people management. In the final chapter, we offer guidance that anyone who manages people can implement. While systems and structures are critical, they don't determine the totality of anyone's experience at work. A rigorous performance evaluation process designed to be fair can't overcome a team culture where women are systematically denied opportunities to work on mission-critical projects and whose contributions are thus less impressive. This chapter addresses the day-to-day practices and micro-moments that add up over time. Leading equitably and inclusively requires a willingness to learn, to be uncomfortable at times, and to critically reflect on how we see others and ourselves, qualities that reside in the manager, not the task list he or she executes. All told, we hope this book will educate, inspire, and motivate. Although workplace gender gaps have become a hot topic in recent years, the reasons for their persistence are often misunderstood or underexamined. All too frequently, women misinterpret organizational obstacles as personal inadequacies. Without the language to identify the subtle biases hindering their progress, they internalize the failures of their companies and industries as their own, and become even less likely to achieve their leadership potential. And when men don't understand how their female colleagues contend with a very different set of circumstances right in the same organization, they too might easily assume that gender imbalances in power and pay reflect merit, not structural barriers. We hope that listeners come away with a better understanding of the systemic disadvantages that aspiring and actual female leaders face, and then turn a clear eye on their own teams, departments, and companies. But this book is also meant to remind listeners of how far we've come. Subtle, yet obdurate barriers continue to stand in the way of gender parity. But the glass is riddled with cracks. Part 1. Office Obstacle Course. Chapter 1. Aiming High and Falling to Earth. Women in Early and Mid-Career. To a woman graduating from college today, the lack of women in the senior ranks of business, as well as other fields, looks like an historical artifact. By the time she is the age of one of the few dozen female Fortune 500 CEOs, she reasons, company hierarchies should more or less reflect the proportion of women in her cohort. She has learned, likely throughout her entire educational career, about female leaders whose breakthroughs made it possible for later generations to rise. She may have read about someone such as former Secretary of Commerce Barbara Franklin, whose story appears after this chapter, who demonstrates that women can hold their own in the halls of power and help clear the way for women who come after them. We conducted in-depth interviews with more than 24 graduating seniors and found that women, and men too, reared on the rhetoric of women's empowerment and accustomed to sharing the classroom and the playing field, anticipated a future in which women leaders are commonplace. Given the well-known benefits of a college degree, young alumni launching professional careers might reasonably assume that gender inequality will have little to no impact on their professional trajectories. While they are well aware of the lingering impacts of discriminatory practices and biased attitudes, by and large, they believe that the underrepresentation of women in leadership, in the words of one graduate, is changing, and that, perhaps, more importantly, it won't matter because I'll kick all their asses anyway. She is not alone in her optimistic, hard-charging outlook. A 2015 survey of millennial women found that about half of women in the workforce for 3 or fewer years, at an average age of 25, believed they would be able to rise to the most senior level of their current organization. In the same survey, women cited opportunities for career progression as the most attractive employer trait. In an ongoing study of MBA graduates that we are involved with, millennial women ranked opportunities for career growth as their second most important overall concern, after quality of relationships, exactly the same as millennial men ranked their concerns. Is it any wonder that young women entering the white-collar workforce view professional success as both desirable and attainable? Today's college graduates grew up in an era when women comprised almost 50% of the U.S. workforce, and girl power was a bright thread woven into the pop cultural products that orbited them at every stage, from children's books to t-shirt slogans to hit songs. This doesn't mean young women are ignorant about lingering gender inequality. Having been witness to the debates about and painful disappointments associated with having it all, Women entering the white-collar workforce are keenly aware of the prevailing sense that family demands interfere with women's careers and see the friction between parenting and work as a general social problem. I think work-life balance means maternity leave and childcare and universal preschool, noted one young woman. A 2015 study of unmarried, childless men and women between the ages of 18 and 32 found that women were cognizant of the effect these kinds of supports would have on their futures. They were more likely to express a preference for an egalitarian relationship, in which they and a future spouse equally shared the responsibilities of breadwinning and caregiving, if told they'd have access to paid family leave, subsidized childcare, and flexible work options. And it is not the case that young women, or men for that matter, are uninformed about structural gender discrimination in the workplace. Indeed, it would be hard for them to be unaware. A search of the ABI/ProQuest database for newspaper and magazine articles on workplace gender gaps, bias, and discrimination, published between 2000 and 2016, yields over 5,000 results. Even before the onslaught of media coverage sparked by the hashtag MeToo movement. For our research into women's early professional experiences, we interviewed more than 24 undergraduate students a few months before their graduation, and then 1 year later. We also followed up with a subset of these graduates 5 years after that, when they had become more firmly established in their careers. When asked as graduating seniors about their expectations for how or whether gender might play a role in their paths, both men and women were quick to acknowledge the existence of inequities. Graduating men acknowledged their privileged position as they looked ahead to starting their post-college jobs. I know there's a lot of sexism in the workplace, and I do anticipate in many contexts being treated like a more responsible person just because I'm a man. A white man, one said. One of his female peers, who planned to attend law school, pointed out that a field like law is still mostly male-dominated. I don't know the statistics on this. I might be wrong. But I know that especially the older people in all these different firms are more likely to be men, and there aren't that many women at that level from a couple of decades ago. One of her peers who had been hired to join a healthcare consulting firm post-graduation had much the same assessment. I know that at my firm there are definitely females, but there's not too many females at the partner level. But that could have just been because of how things were back in the day. The notion that kicking their asses will overcome any potential discrimination authorizes the sense of agency that young women are encouraged to feel in the face of lingering inequality. As another graduating student asserted, "The way I comport myself shows that I'm serious about what I'm doing, and as soon as you get to know me, the gender part doesn't really matter anymore." Having internalized years of confidence-boosting messages about their potential, early career women may even speculate that prior generations were lacking not only opportunity, but also drive. When you look at these consulting firms, if you look at the top tiers, like partners, there are very, very few women. From my perspective, I feel like there is self-selection, to a certain extent, mused one. From her vantage point, gender doesn't loom large in a cohort equally balanced between men and women. At least, going in with my class at a firm, there's going to be a lot of women. I don't really foresee any sort of issue. But this progress narrative is belied not just by research on gender barriers to career advancement, but also by what these same women experienced as their careers took shape. Take our interviewee, Carla. A senior who was awarded a prestigious fellowship with an international marketing firm. She recounted, flying out to London for an interview, and they flew in executives from everywhere in the world to London, and everyone on the other side of the table was a man. And that was sort of weird. But, she pondered as she looked ahead to the fellowship, it was also interesting, because of everyone who was applying, there were only 8 guys and 22 girls. So it's also thinking about the shift there, and how in 20 years the other side of the table is going to look a little bit different. Carla's belief that the executive side of the table will seat more women implies, of course, her own opportunity to ascend to such a role over the next 2 decades. But 1 year later, her faith had been tested. When I met one of the CEOs of the company with all the fellows in New York, where we finished the fellowship, he happened to remember all the guys' names and none of the girls' names. The most senior person in the room was a woman, and the more senior fellow is a woman, and he didn't remember her name. But he remembered the first-year guy in my class. The way that the women in Carla's group of fellows seemed to be almost invisible to a senior leader of the firm is not an isolated anecdote. A large body of research confirms that women are perceived by superiors, peers, and subordinates in ways that diminish their status. Women get praised in performance evaluations, often for stereotypically feminine traits, such as willingness to help out, yet receive lower numerical performance ratings and fewer career-developing stretch assignments than their male peers. Women's contributions to their team's successes go undervalued and unrecognized. Unless their achievements are explicitly called out to observers, women are seen as less competent and having inferior leadership capabilities compared to male peers. And women experience backlash when they are not helpful, even though the kinds of tasks they get criticized for avoiding, such as planning events and taking meeting notes, are neither highly valued by their employers nor associated with career advancement and rewards. The incongruity between Carla's ambitions and the view of women's suitability for leadership implied by the forgetful CEO sets up what will become an ever-widening gap between aspirations and attainment for young women embarking on white-collar careers. The emergence of this gap will recapitulate a pattern that has endured since women began entering professional jobs in large numbers. Our own research on Baby Boomer and Generation X Harvard Business School, HBS alumni, who embarked on their post-MBA careers in the 1980s and 1990s, offers a case in point. Men and women had virtually the same values, rating work that is meaningful and satisfying, professional accomplishments, and opportunities for career growth and development as all highly important. That is, both men and women with the same elite pedigree aspired to fulfilling careers characterized by achievement and advancement. Hardly a stunning insight. But these women saw their actual professional outcomes fall short. They were less likely than men of their same age to be in senior management or even in supervisory roles at all. And it isn't at all clear that these women simply self-selected into less powerful positions. The women expressed lower satisfaction with multiple dimensions of their careers compared to men in their cohorts. Lowered horizons, emerging into careers. 6 years after the aspiring lawyer quoted graduated, now admitted to the bar and working at a large firm, her confidence had faltered. It took a while for it to sink in, especially in my first year here, how often I was the most junior person in the room and the only woman. There are plenty of women at this law firm, but it's still frequently the case that you can be on a conference call with 12 people, standing in a room with 10 people, and you look around and someone's supposed to get water, and guess what? That's you. The fact that it kept happening, that it wasn't just a one-time occurrence, it starts to get to you. Especially the 40th time a man speaks with a complete lack of respect for you or your time or efforts. It does add up, and it gets to a certain volume where you know it's not coincidental. If I'm planning a lunch with 5 people and 2 people have to back out at the last minute, I started to notice that it is often the women of color who have last-minute assignments that come up, and these are often not substantive assignments. And it's painful after a while to see this, and to see how it happens. She is not alone in finding what a difference a few years can make. After 5 years in the finance industry, another young woman found that the lack of female leadership at her firm was not an unfortunate relic of past norms. I definitely felt isolated and different from my peers, and there's definitely a lack of role models. There are fewer women overall, and then as you go up to higher and higher positions, there are fewer and fewer women. I definitely felt like a minority, and felt there.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?